Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 131, where Catherine, Tom, and Sam are discussing Rosabeth Moss Kanter's 1972 book, Commitment and Community, Communes and Utopias in Sociological Perspective, published by Harvard University Press. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
You know, we mentioned in the introduction that the study of the 30 communes in the 19th century was part of Kanter's dissertation research. But then she brings in now observations about the current efforts to establish communes in the 1970s. And so she kind of begins to do a comparison of what's different or what's missing or what are kind of the new challenges that the communes in then her contemporary context have. So in chapter 7, Retreat from Utopia, she explores some of these differences. And, you know, she says, the grand utopian visions of the past have been replaced by a concern with relations in a small group. She has this paragraph on page 166 that I think really just sums up the kind of the big difference that she sees. She says, the contemporary commune movement is characterized by a diminishing scope. By and large, contemporary communes encompass fewer visions of social reconstruction, fewer hopes for permanence, fewer people, fewer demands on those people, and fewer institutions than did the utopian communities of the 19th century. You know, so she does a kind of description of this, as she calls it, the diminishing scope of the contemporary commune movement. And she focuses on the challenge, what I think she says it's the main challenge of communes then, which is the problem of boundaries, right? Now it's harder. It's not just that commitment is the main problem or the main challenge for those communes to survive and to be successful, but now it's a problem of boundaries as well. It's so hard to actually establish clear, firm boundaries between what we would say mainstream society and these groups because everything is so interconnected, both, you know, physically. I guess if we think about today, also, of course, technologically and all those other things. And she makes an argument about the importance of having strong boundaries to understand who belongs to the group, who does not belong to the group, and how the six mechanisms that we reviewed that were so important for utopian communes in the 19th century all rely on having these kind of firm, clear boundaries between us and them, between the community and the rest of society, not just in terms of, I think, physicality, but also in terms of values, right? And vision and identity and what makes us us and difference. If you think back at the mechanisms that we discussed in part one of the podcast, renunciation, communion, like these all talk about renouncing not just the outside people and relationships and spaces, but also practices and values and experiences and actually kind of atoning for those and embracing what is now the new kind of shared order. So yes, I think it's her reflections and what she writes, I think it's timeless in a way, because even if you think about contemporary organizations and not necessarily utopian communes or even communes at all, but the problem of boundaries, it's a huge problem for any kind of organization, right? How to get people to spend more time and effort and loyalty and interest and relationships in the organization as opposed to all of the other aspects of their life, whether that's family life or other kinds of groups or other kinds of organizations that they're also members of.
Yeah, I'd also note that for her, she captured some differences in terms of the way in which the communes justified themselves. In the 1840s, it was a bit more religious in tone. I mean, and a lot of them were more religious. So it was all about salvation. Salvation is the way to, or the justification or the reason why members would want to be part of this commune. Whereas in the 1960s, it was much more of a countercultural movement. And she mentioned that it was dominated by psychological language, such as, you want to be part of us for personal growth, which by itself, I think, along with the physicality portion that, like in 1840s, there was a vast wilderness to be conquered, that there were places where you could go off and you could establish these physically separate communes. You wouldn't be noticed. I mean, you could hide away and you could be ignored, left alone, and you could be there to grow as much as you can. Whereas in the counterculture movement, by that time, there was much more of a visible sign of these groups breaking away and being visible in a sense, which by itself changed the dynamic of the boundary conditions. But it also meant that because the counterculture was formed for different reasons, they used things like personal growth as their narrative. They were much more open about that they're leaving society. It was not left a secret in any way. So those kinds of things changed the dynamic of why communes formed. And she characterized a lot of this under the umbrella of the term retreat commune. These were communes that were formed specifically to escape society, whatever that meant, for religious reasons or away from society's troubles. And then she would say, however, that because retreat was so much oriented on the rejection of society, or rejection of things, it was far more difficult for them to really rally and sustain commitment around something, because people were there for really different justifications. They may have accepted that that the commune's values were better than what they left, but they were more concerned about leaving. And so that meant that the retreat communes tended to be more fractured and tended not to survive as long.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting about actually having those negative boundaries tended to over time disperse whatever commitment those individuals had to that retreat commune. It's very clear reading the book, pretty damning, that retreat and anarchy communes, which she talks about as well, are not viable ways of building an enduring group. And the role that the negative boundaries that arguably are what brought people together in the first place are what actually destroys it eventually. And I guess they do harp back slightly to that more old-fashioned view of, you know, resembling a close-knit family, bringing people together, perhaps around austerity or, you know, very simplistic farming methods and ways of working. But the negative aspects of the boundaries really outweigh the affirmative over time. Usually there isn't much sacrifice for investment involved, which means there's a high turnover of members as well, which isn't very good for the longevity of the group. And without renunciation, communion, she also says, is that group cohesion. And any threats to their existence meant that they dissolved or they changed easily. And she gives some examples of Sunrise Hill and Paper Farm, which had debt issues. There was a fire at Tolstoy Farm and persecution in Oz and Morningstar. But interestingly, maybe there are always going to be short-term elements to it. And obviously within for a short period of time, retreat and anarchic communes provide enough for the needs of that group within the short term, but perhaps they can never be long-term utopian communes. And the ones that survive evolve to have stronger boundaries perhaps as well.
Yeah, so she ties it back to commitment mechanism. She says, retreat and anarchy are clearly not viable ways to build an enduring group. Retreat communes not only fail to institute many commitment mechanisms, but they also establish negative boundaries that tend to disperse whatever commitment members initially bring to the group. So it's this idea of there's no, you know, we're missing the organizing effort. She mentioned several times that what's different about these communes is that they're more focused on like individual freedom rather than constructing kind of a collective project. And we see in a lot of the, you know, her theory of commitment, her definition, and the types of examples that she gives of the mechanisms in all the 30 utopian communes that it has, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's people putting the kind of collective interest in a way immediately above the individual or the immediate individual interest. But because in the end, there is this coherence between, you know, what the organization will end up bringing to the individual. So that is missing in these retreat communes.
Whereas the service ones have that strong pursuit of service to unite them and create very strong boundaries as well, which gives them a stronger case for development over time.
And it's not necessarily service outside. I mean, it could be service inside.
Yeah.
It's a function. There is a, it's not a, a matter of identity that's the glue. It's the function that's served. And she mentions that there are several different types of service communes, as she put it, who basically find their way by providing some sort of a service. A lot of them tend to be education. A lot of them involve some sort of affirmation, strong symbols, strong rituals, strengthen the community. But you know, but the idea is that sense of service, the sense of doing something for others. We mentioned the Oneida case, the commune that she includes in the book, that over time converted from being a commune to becoming now a factory. They manufacture dishware and silverware and stuff like that. They're still active in New York. We still see them in their stuff in our department stores. It wasn't service in terms of service to community, but it was in craftsmanship. It was they transitioned because they developed a commercial a skill which could be turned into commercial activities that allowed for the sustainment of the community. And over time, the commercial activity simply took over. It just became the reason to be for that particular commune, which is why it ceased to be a commune and turned into what it is now, which is, you know, not a bad thing. There's several examples she gave where the commune's ability to sustain itself financially, ward off debt, and do those sorts of things wind up overtaking or supplanting or augmenting with the values to which the commune originally started with. And that by itself is just a natural, I think, an indication of just the maturation of the commune as an organization. You know, if it means that the commune goes away, well, so be it. This is not always good in terms of the original values of the commune.
Yeah. So she brings again this notion of strong boundaries and how important they are to the development of commitment mechanisms. And she compares service communes to retreat communes and in that they develop strong boundaries. She writes that their boundaries are more affirmative than negative, more exclusive than inclusive, and more strict than permissive. Such boundary conditions derive from the existence of a strong central purpose, giving focus and meaning to the group, and providing it the means to distinguish clearly between desired and undesired members or desired and undesired behavior. Its mission enables the group to set criteria for making choices based on whatever will further the mission and justifies its becoming a closed society. The boundary conditions of service communes therefore foster the development of commitment mechanisms that produce strong, coherent communities. So yes, if we think back at the orientations that she believes are very, so important for individuals to remain in organizations, so that these, you know, the moral, affective, and instrumental orientations, you can see how it's much more possible to get or to satisfy these orientations in an organization that has a clear mission, that has clear boundaries, membership, et cetera.
Yeah, and so then as she moves on to, you know, talking about like, and this is from the concluding chapter, the limits of utopia. And she offers some good questions and areas of further consideration, which I think we can start thinking about, well, how does this apply now? Because this was 1972. It's a full half century following this book's publication. Like, for example, the issue of relevance. So to what extent, sort of putting it in kind of my words, I guess, to what extent do communes survive on the basis of their of how strict controlled the boundary is with society? This is a passage that I had highlighted. Many people consider utopias to be escapist or withdrawal movements, and maybe many even accuse commune members of evading their social responsibilities. By retiring from established society, they are doing nothing to correct the problems which afflict that society. And this is an interesting question. Obviously, most of the communes that she discussed didn't really concern themselves with that. They were establishing the communes in order to establish an alternative. And maybe some of them had in mind the hopes of being able to fix society as a result, but it didn't strike me as what was foremost on the minds of many of these commune's finders. But when we start talking about, what is the measure of success of a commune? Is it that as they mature or as they do find their way to their visions of perfection, order, etc., is that measure how much does the commune then ultimately change society? Is that the ultimate measure of success?
That's a very interesting question, you know, because I think in my mind, I've been focusing very much on longevity, how long they lasted as the measure of success. But arguably, you could think about what the impact of that organization was for the individuals involved in it for however long that period of time was. So, for example, just thinking of some of the service communes, if they lasted a bit longer and their view was to serve the personal growth of the members of that community, and they successfully did, indeed, I think Cantor herself actually talks quite positively about her involvement with the growth community at one point. And I think it's in the introduction, talks about the lessons she learned from that she took on to her academic work after that and actually into her life and her own development. So how do we measure success? Is it impact or is it longevity? Just throwing that out there. I don't have the answer.
No, well, I'm going to go ahead and bring up my example, because one of the challenges that I had was that even though she's covering communes, some of which had lasted, you know, close to a century, if not more, I do wonder what would be that tipping point for thinking about when the commune does actually mature enough to be able to influence society in a meaningful way. I came up with one example, and I know it's not, I'm sure it's not the only one, but it happens to be a pretty well-proven one, and that's Christianity. Truth in lending, I'm a Roman Catholic and a confirmation teacher, so I have a little bit of a background in a interpretation of the New Testament. But a lot of the New Testament was written over the growth of the original Christian church, its boundary conditions with Judaism, the Roman Empire, and various other groups. And throughout some of the writings, you kind of see some very strong parallels to the development of communes in Rosabeth Montz Cantor's book, to include battles between some early Christian groups with other early Christian groups over matters of doctrine that ultimately led to the creation of the modern doctrine that most Christianity is based on. And it took about 300 years, this movement surviving, before it actually reached the point where it became the official religion of the Roman Empire under Emperor Constantine in the 4th century. And of course, you can't use the New Testament to the same extent of rigor as you can with, say, the archival research done in the book. So there's no comparing the two. But the parallels to me are striking, and it sort of speaks to late maturation. Like, so what are the conditions that would lead to the commune achieving ultimate success in terms of correcting, air quotes, correcting the ills of society that led the commune to break away in the first place? And number one, it was the size of the movement. By the time that the third century happened, or the fourth century came around, it had pretty much spread throughout the Roman Empire. So you couldn't get away from it anymore. So the scope and spread was like one factor. Another factor is the fact that Christians were having significant economic impact on the empire, such that there were persecutions that were done that didn't break the movement. And so with that, at some point, it just basically became a political decision, you know, in part, that the emperor decided, all right, I'm going to convert to Christianity and I'll go ahead and officially convert the empire. And then I'll be the one to drive the arbitration of whatever doctrine comes to be. And so then the commune becomes the mainstream. I can't think of another example. I suspect somebody can argue for Islam. I don't really know. But it also becomes interesting because how many of the communes that she talked about were breakaways from Christianity? And how many times has the Christianity split in the centuries that followed. So there is something interesting about when a movement actually takes over the mainstream and becomes essentially from being the targeter of society's ills to being the source of society's ills.
Yeah, along similar lines, I think, because I grew up being educated by Catholic nuns, I did think of utopian communes of, you know, the convent, which was connected to the school and all of the different commitment mechanisms, obviously, that anybody in a religious order is part of. You know, it's never going to take over the world necessarily, but all of those things, for a long time anyway, perhaps they're in decline, certainly in Ireland, where I'm from, when there's hardly any nuns anymore. But, you know, all those different mechanisms were absolutely in place. The sacrifice, the investment, the renunciation, the communion, the mortification, the surrender, all of those things. And it's interesting, isn't it, to apply that lens to, like you've done, Tom, there, about the Roman Catholic Church, to other elements of our lives that maybe we wouldn't define as utopian communes necessarily, but of characteristics of it. And the other elements from my working life that I've been involved with is boarding schools in the UK, which, you know, have that sense of utopian commune about them. You know, obviously the sacrifice involved. There's, yeah, and particularly for the staff, actually, I'm not sure how much it is. Has been researched. I haven't looked into it, but I will do, you know, the sacrifice that's involved about living where you work, that is interesting when people, the concept of giving up where you live to be where you work. And of course, there's a whole movement in the UK as well, some of which was the Quaker movement around developing towns and such like Bourneville and others, which were kind of utopian industrial towns rather than communes, I guess. You describe them as, but you know, all of those elements, even in a boarding school where you live and work, and it's very hard to leave. Actually, you know, school days or even on Saturdays and Sundays, there's commitments usually based around things like communion rituals, community rituals, whether it's playing sport or going to church, and you know, the control is there. There's a uniform, even for the teachers, if it isn't explicit that you have to wear a certain type of uniform like the students. There's certain expectations about what you wear, you know, so it's not a diverse range of clothing worn by people usually. Yeah, it's just interesting to apply that to other aspects of life, actually. Maybe, you know, to a certain extent, society is made up of lots of aspiring utopian communes that are at different levels in their development.
I see examples of these mechanisms in, I think, any organization that I can think of, obviously to different degrees. I definitely agree with you too that we see, you know, both examples of these mechanisms, but also the kind of everyday importance of the issue of commitment even more in organizations that both demand a higher commitment from its members, which do tend to be more kind of spiritual, religious, ideological organizations. So unlike the more kind of religious, spiritual examples that you've discussed, I said in part one of the episode, I came to this literature and into this book in particular through my study of social movement organizations and political organizations, where you see examples of all of these mechanisms, right? You see sacrifice. This even extends to volunteer organizations more broadly, right? So people sacrifice time with their families, sometimes sacrifice paid work in order to volunteer their time. They make investments. You know, the longer you spend working towards a certain goal, the more you want to see it through. They renunciate relationships to the outside world, right? It's very common for people that do this kind of more activism or voluntary work to increasingly only have friends in the movement or in the organization. And I see it all the time in ethnographic research, like these anecdotes of, you know, not seeing your family or your like outside friends for months and months at a time. And at the same time, you're have all kinds of rituals and in cultivating all kinds of like strong emotional bonds and relationships with the group, oftentimes even living together or sharing food or, right, something that actually extends the pure strategic purposes of the organization. And there's definitely also a lot of mortification right? The symbolic self-abasement. So rituals that we see, especially in contemporary movements and organizations now, of like, for example, checking in meetings and, you know, saying how you're, you know, what you're struggling with, how you're feeling, and you share that with the group. And so I think the first time that I observed that in one organization, it took me back, you know, also to my kind of more Catholic upbringing of, you know, like confession and like admitting that you didn't reach the goals that week, but you really tried and you're very committed to the goal. And so you see all of these, I think, mechanisms in these types of organizations. Well, and then the last one, the transcendence, which is obviously this belief in a kind of higher purpose, which is, it's a key characteristic of these types of organizations. So yes, I think we see it more clearly in more ideological, value-driven organizations because of the type of, not just type, but because of the intensity of commitment that they require. But I think if we are to take this, you know, to, for example, Gideon Kanda's study of a high-tech corporation, and, you know, he studies like normative control and commitment in the corporation. And I think, you know, reading these two books, you can see a lot of the things that he studied as normative control are kind of the similar to the examples that you could say are, you know, are examples of commitment mechanisms.
Kunda's book is my favorite book of all time, and it inspired my dissertation for my MBA. It just blew my mind when I read it. I just thought it was amazing. And the case study that I did for my dissertation was about a tech company, which was a deliberately developmental organization. And I kind of wish I had known a bit about Cantor, even though it was Martin's framework that I applied to the ethnographic study that I'd done. But it would be very interesting to look at that now. Interestingly, the one that I did the study on, it is a financial issue that will actually be the end of them. So I was fascinated reading this, that's what's happened since, because it was a couple of years ago now. But, you know, there was all the elements, just looking at the different types of commitment mechanisms. In terms of continuance, the company had a no-fire policy. So you could never be fired, but arguably you could never leave either. In terms of the cohesion element, a session, shall we say, rather careful not to identify who they are. There was a session regularly every week where you basically were critiqued publicly by somebody in your company, and they also critiqued somebody. And this was very ritualistic, and it was done on a weekly basis. There was also ongoing feedback from an app, which was live on a screen. So you were either trending up or you were trending down live in real time every single day. I was trending down, by the way, because I'm very suspicious of a researcher. Which was actually very hard to take. The old ego didn't like that very much. So definitely the mortification was in place there. But they had lots of rituals about communion as well. So there was all of the games that people could play and the yoga that they could do together. Even though in real terms, whether people actually went to those things much or not was a subject to debate. That whole mortification surrender piece, there was what they called radical candor, so radical feedback. So your ego was subjugated. And from what I could see, there was very little time actually for life outside of it. So you could take as many holidays as you wanted, but guess what? Nobody took any holidays because the expectation of the peer and the norming of the group was that you were on call all the time, 24/7. Not my idea of utopia, but because people felt that they were developing themselves with a critical lens, I think there's a lot about power and subjugation and control there. But being balanced about it in terms of their business model and what they needed to achieve, it fulfills their purpose. I would say, just from personally speaking, at a huge cost, it's interesting. And it's interesting as human beings that there obviously is something within us that we crave, that we do need that communal experience. And just thinking about boundaries in Kunda's book, there is a brilliant quote in it about a guy, which always made me giggle, getting a fax in the middle of the night from his boss, you know, and he was like, I have to be on call 24/7. It was a fax. And we think how much our devices and communications and technology means we are controlled a lot of the time anyway.
I'm glad you brought up Kunda, because, this is actually one of the things that I was somewhat critical about, but I didn't really know how to express it. You know, she studied utopia. Okay, that's fine. But when we try to look at how these apply in organizations, there's something to be said about dystopia. There's analogs, but I'm not so, like, the mechanisms would seem to be roughly the same, but they're applied very, very differently, such that in a dystopia, you basically are putting the needs of the organization, like, it's a utilitarian look at the membership. The members are not fellows to be salvaged or whatever it is. Yeah, I guess saved, or family members to join or whatever. It's resources to exploit. But otherwise, the mechanisms are roughly the same. I'm totally in agreement with you. The Kunda book showed some of the same types of, you know, mechanisms of commitment applied to the detriment of its members almost purposefully. I think there was even language in Kunda where they're basically saying that part of the organization's self-worth is around defeating the members and subjugating them totally. In the example that you gave. So I think a companion book about dystopias might be interesting because I don't know, you know, like how much of it is the same and how much of it is different. Because that's an example of a dystopia that's economic. People are joining the organization, joined the firm because it was a job. And this was a firm that offered a chance for them to develop something new and exciting. And it was a charismatic leader who had founded the company, who was no longer with the company. I forget the exact details, but it had already been handed over. And that's when stuff started to fall apart. So I think it'd be interesting. How much are they the same and how much are they different?
So I think perhaps it's now that you're pushing us to be more critical of the book, which I don't like because I love the book better. But now that you know what you're just saying, I got me thinking, like, maybe, like, because I do, like, I think it's so important. I think it's so important for organizations and not just for leaders, but for any organizational member to learn about this and to kind of try and think about their organization through this lens. And I actually had the experience of, like, using a little bit of, like, Cantor's theory to turn it into a workshop aimed for activists on how to organize better and more sustainably and stuff. And yes, every time I would, like, teach about these mechanisms and the, you know, like, Cantor's whole theory on commitment, it actually sparked not negative, but, like, critical reactions. You know, it was suddenly, like, activists realizing that these things that make them, like, feel this kind of attachment to the organization are actually pretty, like, can be dark and controlling in a lot of ways. And I think when we look at the mechanisms, they speak a lot about what the individual gives to the organization or invest in the organization or sacrifices for the organization, but we don't see a lot of how the organization gives back to the individual, like going back to Cantor's original idea, you know, conceptualization of commitment as this kind of fine balance that, you know, members get what they need and the organization gets what it needs and everybody's happy, you know, saying. So perhaps that could be, like, interesting for, you know, future research to explore and to look at, right? These more, I wouldn't say, like, positive, but more productive, maybe it's the right word, I don't know, like, form mechanisms of commitment.
Yeah, I had looked at it for similar reasons. I'd live near Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is famous for Hershey chocolate and also the town, very similar to, I think, Cadbury, where it was a town that was founded as sort of like a, you know, in a commune style fashion. It was founded to be a self-contained, not isolated, but self-contained community by which the factory was built, the town was built, the town had everything inside of it that was provided to the members. And so it was an attempt to show organizational commitment to the membership, which is to say that, okay, you give us your labor, you give us your time, and we'll give you back a safe place to live, all of the things that, you know, at least a minimum living standard, an organized community that will provide for each other. And that community is still very much thriving. And of course, since Hershey is now a huge conglomerate, Hershey, Pennsylvania is a very, very wealthy area, has amusement parks, as all kinds of stuff. There is something to be said about what does the organization owe its membership. And one of the challenges that I ran into when I was thinking about it is that you're always going to end up with an issue of, okay, people who are members of society, whether they're in a commune or an organization or not, they give to the society and then society gives back to them. But what is given back to them apportioned by whom? Like, what does the organization owe the individual? What does the society owe the individual? And there was a third category, it escapes me. But the idea being then you end up with questions about, well, okay, for any given thing that an individual needs to survive in the situation, is that owed by the organization or is that owed by society? Which by itself is a bit of a, you know, like you have very divided opinions over that. There's questions about just how much does the organization owe? Do they owe them a career? Obviously, right now, the direction is trending away. And that changes the whole calculus about, say, for example, how you deal, where does the commitment come from for providing for retirees when they have reached old age and are something that crosses my mind once in a while right now.
Yeah, I kind of went down lots of rabbit holes looking at industrial towns that were set up that way, usually by Victorian philanthropists for their staff. A bit like you mentioned, Tom, near us, it would be Bourneville, which was the Cadbury family, Cadbury chocolate, a big Quaker family. And there was lots of others that I just like, one in Yorkshire called, I think it's Yorkshire called Salter, founded by the wonderfully named Sir Titus Salt. And interestingly, there was a charitable element to it and a benevolence to it, but also, you know, an element of control to it, again, from a critical lens, you know. And I couldn't help thinking, reading about these, just thinking about the panopticon, you know, how the feeling that you're always on display, you're always being watched and therefore controlled, that norming of the community, controlling your behavior, that kind of conservative control, but kind of disguised as benevolence. But did it provide, you know, good quality accommodation when people didn't have it, doing very grim jobs? I guess that was better than not providing it and making people work that way, perhaps. But goes back to your idea of dystopia versus utopia. Maybe we need to revisit some of these things in the future.
One other thing that just crossed my mind when you were talking is that another factor, I think, with dystopia separating from utopia is the sense of transparency. I mean, there's a reason why we think of it as the dark side of communes, for example. When I think about the examples that, and she included the case of Synanon.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah,
the rehabilitation rehab for addicts one. Yeah.
Right. And that was a case of dystopia. As it turned out, that only a few years after she published this book, Synanon was raided and the leader arrested and put away in jail for a long time. And transparency was one of the downfalls, or the lack of transparency. The examples that she uses of successful ones tended to have more transparency. There was a sense of, like, yeah, you were under control, but you were kind of aware of the rules. You were aware of the situation. If it came time for you to confess your sins, it was because it was not a secret. It was not like you were tucked away in a hidden location and beaten to submission or things of that nature. Whereas in dystopian sense, or in Synanon's case, dysfunctional context, transparency was not there. Things were hidden and secretive. And I think that that's, if we were to characterize, say, like with Kunda's example, there was a lot of a lack of transparency. It was almost intentional to keep members off guard so that they could, with fear as a motivator, I guess would be the way to put it. And so then, you know, that perhaps brings in, what is it that motivates members to commit? Is it these positive aspects of commitment, like affect, like normative obligation, or the sheer cost benefits of being in the job is better than not being in the job? Or is it held in place by fear or other negative emotions that make one just simply not want to leave?
There is a nice paragraph at the end about the limits of utopia from Cantor, where she says the importance of considering the potential for utopias thus transcends the more limited issue of whether or not individual communes work. Utopian visions of social reconstruction supply an antidote to the pervasive assumption that sick or deviant individuals are both the source and the symptom of social problems, and that the individual must therefore be changed. Utopian thinking and experimentation are aimed at structural reform, at the creation of new social worlds or communities where the old problems no longer arise. Social problems, according to this view, are a function of structural defects in society, can be solved only by constructing a new society or by reshaping social institutions. Well, you can see the roots of her beliefs around structure, certainly there. But I think there's a plea there for a kind of tolerance of the quest for utopia, and that there is a need in society, and in fact it can structurally change things, or elements of it can be adapted into society perhaps to change them in a positive way. Is it an overly positive book though?
I didn't think so. I thought it was, I mean, positive. It was an encouraging book because, let's face it, a lot, you know, when we talk about success in real life, many efforts at communes don't succeed. But the striving, the desire to strive, and in this way, you know, to read the history and to come up with a blueprint for what could work is an affirmative thing. But it's like many other human endeavors, you know, for every so many that succeed and become, whether it's a Shakers or an Oneida or whatever, there's going to be a lot of failure in its wake. And the question becomes, you know, under what conditions would some be willing to try? Because otherwise, if we don't have it as a possibility, then whatever ills that we have of society, we're just going to sit by and do nothing about. And who wants that?
I think it's a positive book in the sense of like making a real effort to understand, perhaps not to have like the ultimately successful utopian movement community, but like to understand why these kinds of organizations are important, how they are limited, and how they can address perhaps some of these limitations. I would say that, and it's a limitation, again, if we look at the empirics in which the book and the theory are based, we have a lot of data that doesn't really involve exploring like people's experiences with being committed, right? So again, going to our maybe not so positive discussion of like the dark sides of, you know, control and commitment and all of this. So I think in that sense, I would say that it's a good book to take into consideration as we are trying to be more critical about like not just these value-driven, idea-driven organizations, but any organization in general. And, you know, the kind of responsibility that comes with asking members or facilitating members to be committed to the organization and everything that they are giving in this development of the commitment. And so, yes, maybe for me, it's more of an invitation to think about more responsible forms of organizing, not so much successful or that, you know, will transcend and impact society as such, but that are more responsible towards its members, I think.
Yeah, same here. It's helped me reflect on commitment at work, both kind of as an employer and an employee, and the expectations of commitment and what they mean and when they can be used positively, but also developing an awareness of where they can be used negatively and how you have to navigate that balance and how you have to create that balance as well sometimes. If there is actually too much commitment versus too little commitment, what you want is elements of, depending on what you're trying to achieve, elements of all of those things, I think, depending on the circumstances, are relevant, and just being mindful that it doesn't tip into dystopia ever.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.